great reporting in the past. Cy Hirsch on Milai, collateral murder, the showing of the Iraqi prisoners in Baghdad with the U.S. soldiers being tortured. Certainly none of these got prior approval from the Pentagon.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's why the press en masse, in unison, almost, you know, there was one organization that essentially is a propaganda outlet for the administration. But everybody else said, no, if we are a free press, we're not going to go along with this. You say, why didn't they just stay there? Well, they're not going to, you know, physically stay in a place where they're told that they can't stay. I think there are legal remedies to be pursued, and I suspect that there will be more developments on this in the near future. The courts are still open to hold officials to account when they exceed their constitutional authority. And I think that's what's going on here, and I suspect that we haven't seen the end of this.
Well, David Schultz, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic at Yale University. A happy belated birthday to Juan Gonzalez. Juan is in Delaware, where today has been there for 2 days giving speeches. You can check our website at democracynow.org. I'll be in Santa Fe, New Mexico tomorrow on October 17th at the Lenzic Theater, where the film Steal the Story, Please will be premiering in New Mexico. Be there at 6 o'clock and being involved with the Q&A after with the Oscar-nominated director, Tia Leson. On Saturday, I'll be at the Woodstock Film Festival in Woodstock, New York, at the Woodstock Playhouse at 3 o'clock. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service providing help from trained counselors for when stress, worry, and sadness strike. Help is available by calling or texting 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland leaders stand up against Trump passing an initiative to protect the city, a judge extends orders impacting Oregon's National Guard troops, and Oregon's Jeff Merkley describes the ICE protests in Portland to other U.S. senators. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 16, 2025. Good evening. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Portland City Council unanimously passed two measures that would oppose or limit federal actions targeting the city, including President Trump's immigration crackdown and attempts to deploy National Guard troops. All 12 councilors passed a resolution that its sponsors call a safeguard for Portlanders targeted by the Trump administration's aggressive federal overreach. They also gave the green light to an emergency ordinance that would codify the city's sanctuary status as federal law enforcement continues to ramp up its arrests and deportations of undocumented immigrants. Portland City Council President Elena Pertle-Guinney is one of the sponsors.
As leaders, I believe it is incumbent upon us to use every single tool we have to stand up for our community as we face a federal administration that is, frankly, hell-bent on singling out Portland in their attempts to move an ideology in our country that does not move us forward. This joint resolution is one of the ways that we are standing up to these attacks and standing up for the incredible progress that our city has made over the past few years. Like every city, Portland has our challenges, but the reality is that Portland has seen decreases in crime in our city. We have seen increases in Portlanders and visitors who are out enjoying our city, and Portlanders from every neighborhood and across the ideological spectrum have united to voice their opposition to federal intervention in our city. This council has also been united on many of the actions that we have taken as a city. And we might not always agree, but as we face down federal actions, in many cases, we are on the same page. I want to express my gratitude as we move forward to Councillor Avalos for initiating the resolution before us. Your work with Council Vice President, myself, Councillor Clark, and with so many stakeholders has been instrumental in giving us a framework for the conversation that we know we will be having over the coming weeks and months. I want to acknowledge that as we put together this resolution and had conversations with the mayor and his administration about some of these pieces and the feasibility of moving them forward, the mayor jumped at the opportunity to begin some of this work. And Mr. Mayor, it has been fantastic to collaborate with you on these efforts. I appreciate the places where you have already begun the work and look forward to being able to help move that forward as we pass this resolution. I am proud of every single Portlander who is showing up and pushing back on the Trump administration.
The Protect Portland Initiative sponsors are Councillors Candace Avalos, Olivia Clark, Tiffany Coya-Mullane, and Elena Pirtle-Ginney. It tasks city officials with gathering information on how the federal government is enforcing its policies and whether federal employees are surveilling Portlanders. It would also require the city to create a rapid response plan for immigration raids and an information hub about the impact of federal immigration enforcement. It would encourage Portland police to maintain and strengthen their separation from federal immigration enforcement and establish a process for investigating potential crimes by impersonators of ICE agents. The council chambers were full as Councillor Candace Avalos introduced the new resolution and an ordinance intended to strengthen the city against federal overreach and ICE. It denounces the presence of the National Guard in the city.
This diagram shows the full framework of the Protect Portland Initiative, the coordinated framework structure our city will use to respond to threats of federal overreach and militarization. These components form a comprehensive, values-driven framework that keeps Portlanders safe, informed, and protected from escalating threats from the Trump administration.
Councillor Tiffany Coya-Mullane spoke in support of the resolution.
I know that we are in terrifying times, and now is the time to speak up. Now is the time to stand firm in our values. Now is the time for us to model being brave rather than staying silent and hoping things will be okay. In World War II, many Portlanders thought being silent and complying was the best way forward as their neighbors were being disappeared. I truly wish that more community leaders and everyday constituents had stood up and spoken out when the federal government forced my own grandparents and many other Japanese Americans into US concentration camps. This evening, this council has the opportunity to stand up and speak out. I'm proud to be part of the work to defend our neighbors and our democracy.
Councillor Samir Kanal introduced the ordinance that codifies the city's sanctuary status into law. Although Portland first became a sanctuary city in 1987, the city's commitments were not legally binding. Here's Councillor Kanal.
These protections that we have are meaningful when they're strong, especially in light of recent heightened threats to the legal protections guaranteed to everyone here in the United States, regardless of their immigration status, as well as to our institutions. We've seen violation and violation after violation of due process rights, and we've seen the current federal government rescind a policy that protected schools, hospitals, and houses of worship from immigration raids. These are also not hypothetical risks here in Portland. All of us have constituents impacted in our district, including District 2. Last month, three people in North Portland were kidnapped by federal agents without any right to due process. They were violently ripped from their cars, they had their windows smashed in, and most heartbreakingly, taken in front of school while dropping off their children in a couple cases. This is happening in other districts too. In District 3, parents are being stalked with ICE agents staked out in front of a public elementary school, and we also, even today, are receiving reports in Cully around the PCC campus. In Chicago, we have videos of ICE agents arresting a 15-year-old girl who's screaming that her parents won't know where she is and that she's 15. And the response is that ICE agents throw her down and briefly kneel on her neck. Closer to home, we've seen in Milwaukee, Oregon, a U.S. citizen born in California, detained by ICE, profiled for the color of his skin and his name, as the Supreme Court has said is legal, but as Portlanders know, is immoral. We have both state and local protections against police officers collaborating with ICE here on federal immigration enforcement. There is a directive of the Portland Police Bureau which operationalizes that resolution for police. We've seen that on the whole, the rules that we have at the state and local level work. They've reduced not only the chances that police officers will support immigration enforcement absent judicial order to zero, but have also shown Portlanders that they can share information about a crime that they've witnessed with Portland Police Bureau officers without risk of themselves being rounded up and deported. And this ability to trust in local police is one of the main reasons that sanctuary status supports public safety. The 2017 study, The Effects of Sanctuary Policies on Crime and the Economy, which was cited in our 2017 resolution, shows that crime is lower and economies are stronger in sanctuary counties compared to non-sanctuary counties. And that's great. It's really great. But we are more than a sanctuary police bureau. We are a sanctuary city. And we need to provide support to our employees and their supervisors so that they know their rights and can meet their responsibilities.
So this new ordinance writes the city's sanctuary status into law. Around 70 people signed up to give public testimony. Prior to the meeting, protesters gathered outside of City Hall. A marching band featuring players in banana costumes played outside. This all came after a federal judge Wednesday extended her two temporary restraining orders that prevented President Trump from deploying Oregon National Guard members or any National Guard members to Portland for another 2 weeks. Oregon U.S. District Judge Karen Immergood granted the extensions as all sides wait for a ruling from the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on whether her order will stand. It stopped the deployment of 200 Oregon National Guard troops to protect the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building in South Portland. Immergood says she also plans to proceed with a three-day trial on October 29th on the states and cities lawsuit challenging the deployment. She says the trial will be limited to two legal standards that her temporary restraining orders rested on, federal code that sets out criteria the president has to meet to put National Guard troops under federal control, and the 10th Amendment, which protects the state's sovereign interests and says that powers not delegated to federal officials are reserved to the states. Immergood issued her 31-page ruling on October 4th, granting the state and city of Portland a 14-day restraining order blocking the Oregon Guard deployment. Her order came after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth sent a memo to Oregon on September 28th. It said he was putting 200 Oregon troops under federal control for 60 days to protect the ICE field office in Portland from nightly protests. Meantime, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley met with fellow Democratic senators today, talking about the impact of Trump's actions on their states.
In my state of Oregon, we are having demonstrations against the federal agents who have come in to provoke violence, and those demonstrations are demonstrations of joy and whimsy because the people of Portland decided not to take the bait. They understand that the president's trying to create violence and use violence to justify more authoritarian power, and that this idea of deploying our military against domestic demonstrations is a key part of an authoritarian setting the stage for future actions, becoming the courts, giving approval to it, getting the military used to taking commands to go in. And I think the response in Portland has been incredible. Complete restraint, even when provoked by federal agents, proceeding to do things like women coming down doing pastries in pajamas, and folks bringing down their pets and doing paws, as in paws of a dog, paws for peace, and proceeding. We are protesting. We're doing it Portland style because we understand what the president's up to, and we're not going to be supporting or helping his authoritarian strategy.
And as the federal government shutdown continues, Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas participated in a Capitol Hill hearing about affordability for the average American.
Thank you to my colleagues for convening this critically important hearing today. Last week, I was here in this room and shared stories from my own constituents in Oregon's 6th District, and I look forward to hearing from you. And it is so crucial that we do put a real face to the millions of Americans who could lose their health care as a result of the Republicans' cruel health care cuts. And my question is for Jackie. Because of your ACA health care, you are able to really continue to operate your small business knowing that you have health insurance. And my question is a two-part. First of all, what portion of your budget it is comprised of healthcare, of your housing, your groceries, and your healthcare? What portion is healthcare? And then what would it mean for your small business if you lose your ACA coverage? What tough choices will you and your husband be forced to make between your livelihood and your health?
I would say healthcare. Give me an average number, 20%. Okay. If I calculate and I crunch the numbers, 20%.
So it's a large portion.
That's all of healthcare.
Yeah.
combined into one. Prescriptions, premiums. So 20%. And then second part of your question is, if we're not to be able to afford our premiums, what would that do to us?
And what kind of decisions would you have to make?
Again, we've had the discussion, and this is my family alone, and there's many out there having this discussion right now. So it's my husband and myself, and we have had the discussion not knowing what our premium will be. So if it triples, we cannot afford it. So at that point, I would do my due diligence and shop around and probably get a plan with less benefits, higher deductibles. Maybe I might save money in the premium. It would take a lot of research and a lot of work on my end. I'm starting back at the beginning again, where I was years ago when I lost my job and we lost our insurance coverage through my employer. So it would be devastating for us. So that 20%, we're not in a financial position for that to go up to 50% of our income for healthcare. 20% right now is expensive for us.
Do you pay taxes?
Yes.
You pay taxes.
This
is part of what you pay into. And the Affordable Care Act is not something that is free. We all pay taxes. This is healthcare that you pay for. This is not a freebie.
We have paid into taxes
into the system
since we have been working.
Thank you.
And we will continue to do so.
And you're
whether we have health insurance or not.
And you run a business that pays into your local economy.
That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you for running that business. Thank you for supporting your community. And I hope we can continue to afford, and I hope the Republicans come back, lower the cost of healthcare for all of us so that we can make sure that you stay in business, that you and your husband can afford healthcare, that you can remain well, that you can keep working and offer your community the services that you offer now.
Today is World Restart a Heart Day. It's meant to increase public knowledge of bystander intervention and survival rates from sudden cardiac arrest, which strikes almost 350,000 Americans, adults, and children each year. An Oregon teacher is now back in the classroom after a school nurse saved her because of CPR training. Isabel Charlet has a story.
9 out of 10 cases of cardiac arrest are fatal, but preparedness can save lives. And a teacher at Mackenzie River Community School is living proof. When the school's registered nurse, Liz Moosey, noted medical equipment used in the event of cardiac arrest was in disrepair, she launched an upgrade campaign. Her foresight paid off when a teacher experiencing cardiac arrest collapsed in the hallway just outside Moosey's door. Moosey, a CPR instructor for the American Heart Association, sprang into action.
She walked out of my office and another teacher walked out right behind her and literally seconds later started screaming, "Help!" So I got her on the ground and I just started CPR.
Moosey continued CPR while another staff member called 911, and soon the teacher resumed breathing on her own. But the presence of a trained responder and modern life-saving equipment helped make the difference. Today is World Restart a Heart Day, a global initiative aimed at raising awareness about the importance of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, known to improve survival rates from sudden cardiac arrest. For Moosey, upgrading the school's equipment wasn't enough. She also developed a cardiac emergency response plan and began assembling a team, organizing drills, and training staff. Knowing CPR and how to use an automated external defibrillator, or AED, can double or triple the chance of survival in the event of cardiac arrest. She says you don't need to be a medical professional to save a life.
It's possible with just basic hands-only CPR, you can save a life. Anyone can call 911 and start CPR and get an AED on.
The American Heart Association is working to pass policy through the Oregon legislature that would ensure all public schools have accessible and workable AEDs, a written cardiac emergency response plan, and that they require CPR training for appropriate staff. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
And in the face of legal pressure, the Trump administration has switched course on student loan forgiveness, impacting people in Washington state. Here again is Isabel Charlet with more on that.
The Trump administration has resumed student loan forgiveness under the income-based repayment program, providing relief to borrowers who had been left in limbo after the program was paused in July. According to a 2023 report, nearly 800,000 Washington residents hold outstanding federal student loans, owing together about $28 billion. Courtney Marabetta is with the Washington chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, which filed a class action lawsuit against the Education Department, arguing the freeze was unlawful and unfair.
We have managed to finally put enough pressure on the Trump administration that they have been forced to do something that is a benefit to working Americans. It is literally life-changing to qualify.
The program allows borrowers working in public service, such as education or nonprofits, to have their remaining loan balances canceled after 20 or 25 years of qualifying payments. Marabetta adds that this ruling only applies to borrowers under the IBR program. Other income-driven repayment plans such as SAVE or ICR are still facing delays or legal barriers tied to court rulings. Marabetta says many AFT members end up owing much more than they originally borrowed for school despite making regular payments. She cites one example of a teacher who left grad school owing about $35,000 for her master's degree in education, and after years of making payments, owed nearly double that.
The servicers have pushed people into more expensive pathways for repayment as they have benefited from people paying more over time.
Marabetta says AFT has many members in Washington who struggle to live in the communities that they teach in, particularly for contingent faculty.
We have members who spend more time commuting than they can with students because that's simply the physical reality of working at two or three or more jobs in order to get by.
Adjunct faculty can qualify for loan forgiveness through a national policy known as the Adjunct Multiplier, Marabetta explains, which allows them to multiply their in-class instruction hours by 3.35. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in a case that legal experts say could undercut the heart of the Voting Rights Act. Mike Moen explains why this is such an important case for Native communities.
Tribal advocates are watching closely with a similar legal fight playing out concerning Native American districts in North Dakota. The case heard this week stems from the drawing of political boundaries in Louisiana. Plaintiffs are challenging the constitutionality of Section 2 of the VRA, which prohibits racial discrimination regarding voting practices and procedures. The Native American Rights Fund's Jacqueline DeLeon says there's a presumption from challengers that barriers to civic engagement are a thing of the past for minority populations.
And unfortunately, what we know through our work across Indian country is that racial discrimination is alive and well, and that unfortunately, Native voters are discriminated against often.
She says gutting Section 2 would embolden states to redraw maps that further weaken the voting power of communities of color. The legal push from conservatives comes as President Donald Trump pressures GOP-led states to update their maps before the 2026 midterms. Plaintiffs contend that still factoring in race during redistricting is discriminatory. In the North Dakota case, tribal advocates last month appealed to the high court, with the focus there on whether private citizens can sue to enforce Section 2. DeLeon says while these cases have some differences, they both signal a critical juncture for long-standing legal protections.
Both cases represent an existential threat to the Voting Rights Act, and it's incredibly important that voters and that just American citizens are aware that our foundational civil rights statute is under threat.
DeLeon wouldn't speculate on upcoming decisions, but legal experts say in the Louisiana case, several conservative justices appeared poised to side with plaintiffs. Legal experts say Section 2 is the last remaining pillar of the Voting Rights Act, with other elements recently facing setbacks in the courts. However, the Supreme Court did rule in 2023 that Alabama Republicans likely violated the law when drawing their maps. This is Mike Moen.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears the case on race and redistricting. An elected Arizona congresswoman hasn't even been sworn in yet, and Congress might roll back marine mammal protections. Here are some of the stories impacting our democracy in today's edition of 2025 Talks.
What exactly do you think the endpoint should be, or how would we know for the intentional use of race to create districts?
Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and court conservatives may use a current case to change how race impacts congressional districts. Louisiana's map included an additional majority black district to remedy a Voting Rights Act violation, but it's being challenged for a second time as a racial gerrymander by a group that describes itself as non-black voters. Just 2 years ago, SCOTUS confirmed a section of the VRA is constitutional in requiring what are known as minority opportunity districts, but observers say this time the court could weaken or strike down that section of the law, letting states bend to pressure from President Donald Trump and redraw as many as 19 districts to favor Republicans in time for the midterms. Arizona's Attorney General is threatening legal action against Speaker of the House Mike Johnson if he doesn't swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva. Johnson canceled previously scheduled votes and is keeping the House out of session throughout the ongoing government shutdown. Grijalva says there is no reason other than politics to delay swearing her in 3 weeks after she won her special election.
This delay is not procedural, it's intentional. Earlier this year, Speaker Johnson swore in two Republicans from Florida with less than 24 hours after their elections during a pro forma session.
She and others attribute the delay to her being the last needed signature on the discharge petition for the Epstein files, forcing the House to take action on it. Johnson continues to say she will be sworn in soon, although he won't say when. According to the New York Times, the Trump administration has authorized the CIA to take covert actions against the government of Venezuela. The U.S. military is already striking small ships off the coast of Venezuela, which Trump claims cartels are using to smuggle drugs. The president says attacks on land may be next. With the Gaza ceasefire still fragile, Hamas says it already turned over all the bodies of dead hostages that it can. Israel is restricting aid for the Strip, saying more bodies must be turned over. Conservation groups nationwide are warning a rollback of protections for marine mammals could hurt not just those animals, but the broader ocean ecosystems as well. Congressional Republicans have proposed stark revisions to the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act, a landmark law credited with the recovery of several species of whale. Gib Brogan with the advocacy organization Oceana says possible legislation would change the definition of harm to these species and lower population goals.
The draft bill proposes a wide range of deep, unnecessary changes that will have significant effects on marine mammals across the country and around the world.
I'm Edwin Javier.
Bethel Search and Rescue's building is busy with volunteers and supplies, and Alcatraz Island hosts the annual Indigenous Peoples Day Sunrise Gathering. Brian Bull from Eugene, Oregon, has today's edition of National Native News.
Donations are pouring in to Bethel Search and Rescue in the wake of the catastrophic storm that hit the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta over the weekend. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the building has been buzzing with volunteers and recent evacuees, some of whom have lost everything.
At the Bethel Search and Rescue building, families from villages hit hardest by Sunday's storm grab items from long tables overflowing with clothes and essential goods.
There was one I just had spoken with. He had mentioned that he can finally change his clothes.
Volunteer Caitlin Andrew says her father and other family members are still sheltering in the coastal community of Guigilingog. The storm, remnants of Typhoon Halong, nearly completely destroyed the village, and roughly 400 people sheltered at the school awaiting evacuation on Tuesday evening.
They're messaging us and letting us know what they need over there right now.
Andrew says that within an hour of opening the donation center on Monday, totes and bags from community members quickly filled up the corner of the one-story building.
That pile over there was literally almost to the ceiling until we started organizing things.
The donations include winter boots, baby formula, and basic hygiene products, shampoo, toilet paper, and tampons. Most of the items are going directly to people already evacuated to Bethel. Some are being boxed up and sent to those still sheltered in coastal villages. Volunteer Angie Walter stacks three boxes filled with clothes for a family in the Nelson Island community of Nightmute.
The bottom box is mostly boots, and there's hats and gloves, pants and tops for a boy and a girl, and I guess maybe the dad and the mom.
Volunteers say that with winter just weeks away, more cold weather gear is needed. While some communities will be able to rebuild what was lost, others face a bleak future or total uncertainty of whether their community will ever recover. Andrew, who still has family members stuck in the most affected area, says that all she and other volunteers can do is offer their support for people grappling with the concept of leaving behind their traditional homes.
Some of them don't want to because that's where they grew up and that's their home. And so I think it's just to be there for them and to make sure that they know that they have a place.
Meanwhile, outside of the building, volunteers scramble to make space for roughly 10 pallets of goods that have just arrived from Anchorage. The donations are coming in from all over, and volunteers say they're critical, with 100 people already evacuated to Bethel and hundreds more on the way. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
This past Monday, many cultural observances were held in honor of Indigenous Peoples or Native American Day, including an annual event at Alcatraz Island in Northern California's Bay Area. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that the Sunrise Gathering features prayer, dancing, and songs, despite the many closed national parks and in protest of President Trump's plans to reopen Alcatraz as a prison. Historically, a large gathering of Native people occupied the island prison from 1969 to 1971. With the exception of 2013 during another government shutdown, the annual gathering has taken place with another one held on Thanksgiving Day. The International Indian Treaty Council hosted the event. And during this week in 1891, people mourned the passing of Sarah Winnemucca, the first Native woman who published a copyrighted work in the U.S. Her book, Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims, was an autobiographical work published in 1883. Her birth name was Thakmetane, or Shellflower. I'm Brian Bull.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday,
October 16, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Anna Wilcox, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective.